content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. For our first article today, from the technology department, the carry-on baggage bubble is about to pop. Airplanes weren't made for this much luggage, by Ian Bogost. A man grunts and sighs in the crowded aisle next to you. His backpack swats your shoulder. If an overhead bin is shut, that means it is full, a flight attendant announces over the intercom. A passenger in yoga pants backtracks through the throng with a carry-on the size of a steamer trunk. Sorry, sorry, she mutters. The bag will need to be checked to her final destination. Travelers squish aside to make way for her, pressing against one another inappropriately in the process. Nobody is happy. Among the many things you hate about air travel, the processing of cabin luggage is ascendant. Planes are packed, and everyone seems to have more and bigger stuff than the aircraft can accommodate. The rabble holding cheap tickets who board last are the most affected, but even jet-setters with elite status seem to worry about bag space. They hover in front of the gates, hoping to board as soon as possible. Gate lice, they're sometimes called. Travelers are rightly infuriated by the situation, a crisis of carry-ons that someone must be responsible for and for which someone must pay. I'm a traveler who believes that someone must pay, and on a recent flight to Fort Lauderdale, I came across a suspect. The idea popped into my brain and then got stuck. My theory was a simple one. We know that airlines overbook their seats, then count the on-no-shows and rebookings to make the system work. This helps ensure that each flight will be as full as possible, but it also leads to situations where passengers must be paid to take a different flight. What if the airlines are doing the same thing with overhead bins and allowing more carry-on luggage than a plane can even hold? What if they're overbooking those compartments in the hopes or expectation that some passengers won't bother with a rollerboard and will simply check their bags instead? If that's the case, then the aisle pandemonium can't be chalked up to passengers' misbehavior or to honest confusion at the gate. No, it would mean that all this hassle is a natural outcome of the airline's cabin stowage arbitrage. It would indicate inconvenience by design. As I tried to settle in my seat, ducking under other people's arms, a sense of outrage began to tingle in my fingers and my toes. When I looked around the cabin, I know I saw a scene of mass betrayal. No matter how hard we try, I thought, we'll never squeeze our bags into these bins. Gate checks are inevitable. The fix is in. Could overbooking luggage be the root of the carry-on crisis? I needed to investigate. On a subsequent flight to Phoenix in an American Airlines Boeing 737-800, I began to gather evidence. As soon as the seatbelt sign had extinguished, I got up to count the seats in bins. There were 26 six-seat rows in economy and 4 rows of 4 seats in first class, for a total capacity of 172 luggage-encumbered souls. Hanging above those seats were 28 large overhead bins, plus 2 smaller ones at the front. Boeing later told me that the large bins are made to hold up to 6 standard-size carry-on bags each. 6 times 28 is 168. So if we assume that each of the smaller bins can hold at least another pair of bags, there would be enough space for every passenger on a full flight to stow something overhead. It seemed my theory was debunked. Sort of. The large bins, which were a relatively new swing-down design that Boeing calls space bins, must be loaded in a certain way to reach their maximum capacity. That means inserting the bag sideways and upright so that they slide like books onto a shelf. The bags loaded like books must also conform to the expected size. The U.S. airline standards limit dimensions of carry-on bags to 22 by 14 by 9 inches. But many people bring on bags that are much larger or are oddly shaped. Some bring two. If the margin for error in the bins is very small, as appeared to be the case on my flight to Arizona, then how likely is it that every piece of luggage on a full flight will end up stowed away? The tenuous conditions of my trip to Phoenix turn out to represent something like a best-case scenario. Not every plane is as well-equipped as the aircraft that happened to be flying me that day. Boeing space bins are optional for airplane buyers, an upgrade over smaller models that are meant to hold just four bags each. An American Airlines spokesman told me that 80% of its mainline fleet has the larger bins. The rest have compartments built for the luggage habits of our forebears. Even with the larger bins installed, a given plane's capacity for holding people could still exceed its theoretical space for those people's suitcases. That's because Boeing's bins are stock equipment, a spokesman told me, while each customer, i.e. each airline, designs its own seats and specifies the distance between them. That space allowance, called pitch in the business, has been contracting over the years so that more seats can be crammed in. Naturally, all of those extra passengers end up sharing the same number and volume of overhead bins. At the same time, travelers have been given new incentives to engage in the aisle scrum for bin space. Back in the day, we used to buy an airline ticket, and many things were included. Laurie Garrow, a civil engineering professor at Georgia Institute of Technology, who specializes in aviation travel behavior, told me. And then, after the 2008 financial crisis, that's when all the debundling started. Under pressure from rising fuel costs, competition from low-cost carriers, and other factors, airlines separated standard perks such as free checked bags into individual services, which travelers could buy or forego. To dodge those added costs, more people chose to carry on. Those fees are not the only factor. Southwest Airlines passengers who can check two bags for free still seem to fight over limited space in bins. And business travelers, whose ticket class or airline status often comes with free checked bags, still like to store their stuff overhead. That's because they value their time and don't want to stand around a baggage carousel. Nor are they willing to accept the hassle of potential mix-ups with checked luggage. The bags themselves have also changed. Today's hard-shell cases don't compress to fit as soft-shell bags do, which may erase whatever latitude remains in a bin-to-passenger ratio that is already way too low. The luxurious space bins on my flight to Phoenix just barely seemed to satisfy the airline's implied promise to its passengers, and I hadn't bothered to consider other complications. Passengers in bulkhead rows may not have under-seat storage and thus send their personal items up top, too. And some bin space might be reserved for defibrillators or other safety equipment. Perhaps this isn't quite the scam I had initially imagined, but the entire carry-on situation is dangled over a precipice, ready to tumble into the void at any moment. Precarity of stowage leads to mayhem. The number of carry-ons being carried on has been rising since the great debundling, and more passengers are flying, too. In the hellscape that results, passengers squeeze past one another as they roam in both directions down the aisles in an often fruitless search for empty bins. By 2011, boarding times had already doubled compared with the 1970s, and they've crept up even further in the past 5 years. Based on my experience, the gate lice epidemic is also getting worse. Solving the carry-on crisis is difficult. The variables are many, and the incentives to change them are in conflict. The global airline industry now makes almost $30 billion a year from baggage fees. With rising fuel costs, increasing salaries for pilots, and the usual Wall Street pressures for quarterly performance, airlines aren't likely to give up that income anytime soon. And yet, airlines also have an incentive to reduce the time it takes to load and unload planes, because doing so would allow them to turn flights around faster. If passengers had fewer carry-ons, airline schedules would be more efficient. Boeing has researched and defined the maximum volume that a carry-on bag might reasonably occupy, given current consumer preferences and trends in luggage manufacturing. Teague, the firm that has designed all of Boeing's aircraft interiors since 1946, when overhead bins were nothing more than hat racks, incorporates that figure into its holistic vision of an aircraft's interior. Windows, lavatories, galleys, and yes, overhead bins. Innovations in the latter tend to go in one direction only. It's like an arms race between Airbus and Boeing over who has the biggest bins, David Young, a Teague principal industrial designer who has worked on cabin features for 20 years, told me. The design process is intricate. Overhead bins must be designed such that they never, ever open accidentally, and also that they can be closed with little effort by passengers and flight attendants of various sizes and strengths. The bins must be easy to reach without getting in the way of passengers' bodies during boarding and deplaning. Young and his colleagues also must ensure that baggage doesn't shift around so much inside a bin that it falls out when a passenger goes to retrieve it. That task is made more difficult by the slippery injection-molded plastic bags that are now in vogue, which have a greater tendency to slide around in bin. I was impressed by Young's account of the attention that goes into every detail of the bin's design, but the whole affair felt like it might be accelerating the problem in a way that adding lanes to a freeway can create more traffic than it alleviates. If the cabin designers are always trying to expand overhead bins to accommodate larger and more numerous carry-on bags, then surely passengers will respond by choosing and bringing ever bigger bags. So what then, should Boeing shrink the bins just to reverse the trend? Young and Garrow proposed another way. Just check your bag, they both suggested, as if, this Buddhist avian manner could easily be put into practice. Garrow told me she started packing less and using hotel laundry and dry cleaning services just so that her carry-on is smaller. Young says he brings only a bag that fits underneath the seat in front of him. Fine ideas, I suppose, but the carry-on crisis won't be solved by asking passengers to behave more sensibly. For the moment, we can't even seem to figure out how to use the newer, more spacious bins the way we're meant to. On the flight back home, passengers loaded them haphazardly, with some bags laid flat instead of on their side. As a result, those bins carried four bags at most, not six. When I asked my flight attendant how passengers respond to her instruction to stow each bag like a book, she shrugged. I don't know. Sometimes I stack books flat on my shelves. One passenger on my flight expressed her perplexity aloud. Like a book? She sounded confused, but also, in a way, concerned, as if her suitcase might not feel so comfortable on its side. I found this endearing. Roller bags are a little bit like pets, skittering across the floor, low to the ground, always by our side. Maybe people like to bring their bag on board because they want to have it close, as if the suitcase were a friend with whom they might share the loneliness of travel. When I floated this idea to Young, he worried that I might be flying too much, and brought me back to earth with a much more practical concern. Overhead bin design has reached its limit, he said. The cabin luggage compartments won't be getting any bigger. I'd say we're at a breaking point. We've hit as big as we can go. That means some other solution to the carry-on crisis must be found. Some other far more radical solution. Maybe we don't need carry-ons at all, Young went on. He was whispering almost as if his secret made him sound bananas, which it somewhat did. Someone needs to step out and say, we're not doing this anymore. This isn't the right experience for air travel. What if the overhead were instead restored to its original purpose, as a modest rack for hats, coats, shoulder bags, and briefcases? Already planning for this is possible, if still unthinkable, future. Teague has started to design all of its interiors to include an option without any overhead bins at all. Imagine how light you'd feel up in the cruising altitude with no bags encumbering you and a stretch of empty space above your head. But where would the bags go, I asked, not yet ready to loosen the grip on my rollerboard. Maybe you drop them off early at the air train station, he explained, or later at the gate. Or maybe you'd board the plane with them, just as you always have, but then you could lower them down into a hold from the cabin floor. Who knows? Young's point is, nobody has even tried to imagine an alternative. Travelers ought to dream of a future without carry-on luggage, rather than one that expands endlessly to contain it. Next, what makes Russia's economy so sanctions-resistant? By James Sorowicki. When recently Tucker Carlson posted a short video clip of himself visiting a Russian supermarket and raving about how great the bread was and how low the prices were, and another clip from his trip to a knockoff McDonald's restaurant in Moscow, he received plenty of well-deserved mockery. Carlson seemed both willfully ignorant, pretending that he didn't know that prices are lower in Russia than in the U.S. because Russia is much poorer than the U.S., and oddly credacious. Still, amid the weirdly pro-Russian and anti-American rhetoric, Carlson's travelogue did point out something worth paying attention to. The sanctions that the United States, Europe, and other industrialized democracies have imposed on Russia in the 2 years since its invasion of Ukraine have not devastated the Russian economy. Although the initial announcement of sanctions led to a crash in the value of the ruble and bank runs, the economy soon stabilized. After falling a less-than-expected 2.1% in 2022, Russia's GDP actually grew last year and appears to be on pace to do so again in 2024. The sanctions have reshaped the Russian economy, making it worse for consumers and more dependent on government spending, while seriously denting its long-term prospects. But they have not crippled the economy nor put any real pressure on Russia to end its war in Ukraine. So although the Biden administration just announced a whole new round of sanctions designed to punish Russian President Vladimir Putin for the death in prison of opposition politician Alexei Navalny, they are unlikely to be any more effective in bringing Putin to heel than earlier ones. If the sanctions on Russia have had limited impact, that's in part because they were limited in scope. They did involve serious measures. They included the freezing of $300 billion in Russian central bank assets, a ban on transporting Russia crude oil using any Western services unless the oil is sold for $60 a barrel or less, restrictions on technological exports to Russia, and targeted sanctions against thousands of Russian individuals, companies, and ships. Even though the price of Russian oil was capped, however, Europe did not stop buying it, or natural gas, although imports of Russian gas have fallen sharply, because it couldn't afford to. Some Russian banks were cut off from access to the SWIFT banking network, but unlike the conditions imposed on Iran in 2012, the ban was not total. Some of Russia's biggest banks were exempted, and the West is still doing business with Russia. A little less than half of European exports to Russia, for instance, are under sanction. Beyond that, the nature of the sanctions regime meant that its effectiveness was bound to be limited. To be truly effective, sanctions need to be global. In the case of Russia, though, the second biggest player in the global economy, which is China, is not only not participating in the sanctions, but is actually helping weaken their impact. China was already Russia's biggest trading partner before the war in Ukraine, and in the past 2 years, trade between the two countries has soared, with China importing more and more Russian oil and gas. Countries such as Turkey, India, and the United Arab Emirates have also helped Russia circumvent sanctions by serving as trade intermediaries that permit the transshipment of Russian oil and the importation of important technological products, such as microchips. These conduits have enabled Russia to avoid the full effect of the $60 a barrel cap on its oil price, which was an important part of the sanctions package, and keep the imports flowing in. On top of this, Russia's economy was reasonably well prepared to weather the cost of sanctions, perhaps in part because it had dealt with them before. Russia had low levels of sovereign debt, which means that it didn't depend on much foreign lenders to pay its bills. It had a large current account surplus, indicating that it was exporting much more in goods than it was importing, and it had a big buildup of national wealth fund. Russia also responded to the sanctions by imposing strict capital controls, restricting the ability of Russians to move money out of the country. Russia has been helped, oddly enough, by the fact that its economy lacks a major manufacturing sector and doesn't make much that people in the West want to buy. Because Russian exports of manufactured goods are not that important to the economy, cutting off access to Western markets for those goods isn't a big deal. For a country with an economy heavily reliant on the export of such goods, like Vietnam, which is highly dependent on selling abroad stuff such as phones, textiles, and shoes, Western sanctions would be much more damaging to them. Finally, Russia's economy has gotten a big stimulus from a sharp increase in government spending. A few months after the war in Ukraine began, Russia pushed through increases in state pensions and subsidies, as well as boosting payments to soldiers and their families. Last year, public sector employees also got significant raises. And, most important, Russia has ramped up military spending. The result is that state spending now accounts for more than a third of Russia's GDP. Military Keynesianism has helped the economy to stay afloat and wages to grow briskly. Putin has thus managed to soften the cost of sanctions and minimize public discontent with the economy. But this comes with a price. His doing so has made the modern Russian economy look strangely like the old Soviet economy, highly dependent on exporting raw materials and on military spending, technologically limited and generally unfriendly to consumers. A lesson in the 1980s Gorbachev era was that the economy that looks like this ends up as a lumbering giant of inefficiency and stagnation. This is where the sanctions have hit the hardest, restricting Russian access to advanced technologies in transportation and communication, to say nothing of digital innovation such as artificial intelligence. Sanctions have also made it more difficult for Russia to build out energy infrastructure. Western companies and investors have exited the country, and capital controls on the economy's dependence on government spending mean that the state is playing a bigger, more heavy-handed role in the economy. If Putin were a different kind of leader, this might matter to him, but his ambitions are territorial and imperial, not economic. The fact that sanctions are making the Russian economy less consumer-friendly seems very unlikely to persuade him to reconsider what he's doing in Ukraine. If anything, the impact of sanctions has strengthened, not weakened, his own hold over the economy. In his statement about the new round of sanctions on Russia, President Joe Biden said that they would ensure Putin pays an even steeper price for his aggression abroad and repression at home. If so, it's a price Putin seems more than happy to pay. Our next article, Apollo's sequel will be a gold rush, by Marina Corin. For the past few days, Mission Control in Houston has been talking to the moon. It's a throwback to an earlier age, with a few tweaks. Mission Control is not NASA, but a private American company called Intuitive Machines, sending instructions to an uncrewed lander about the size of a telephone booth. The spacecraft made a nail-biting descent to the lunar surface last Thursday, with a last-minute software patch to make up for manufacturing navigation sensors. One of the spacecraft's legs snagged on the surface and the whole thing tipped over, landing on its side. But still, it was the first time an American spacecraft had landed on the moon in more than 50 years. The mission is the latest event in what has quickly become the busiest decade in lunar exploration since the 1960s. Government agencies and private companies in the United States, China, India, Japan, Israel, and the United Arab Emirates have all dispatched lunar landers in the past 5 years, with varying degrees of success. Many more missions, both uncrewed and crewed, are in the works. The U.S., the only country so far that has set people on the moon, aims to repeat the feat as early as 2026. And then start building a sustained presence on the surface. Several of the new missions, like Apollo before them, are run by national governments, including India's and China's. The moon is not exactly a milestone that it would have been 50 years ago, but it does signify a level of capability on a particular aspiring space power. John Logsdon, a space historian and founder of the George Washington University's Space Policy Institute, told me, "Whereas the Cold War race involved two mighty competitors, the track is now full of both established and emergent space powers, some working together to explore the moon. The space arena is also full of private aerospace companies. This is a key difference between our modern moon fixation and the original edition. Firms from Israel and Japan have dispatched spacecraft to the moon, and Intuitive Machines is one of 14 firms that NASA has contracted to deliver various lunar payloads in the coming years. Its lander rode into space on a rocket built by SpaceX, which launches all kind of payloads at a blistering cadence, serving as Uber for space. There's a new motivation fueling private moon missions today, ice, hints of which scientists detected in the 1990s. The Intuitive Machines lander touched down near the moon's south pole, a region of shadowy craters that might harbor water ice. Future explorers could melt that water and run it through life support systems, or break out its hydrogen and oxygen to produce rocket fuel, the kind of infrastructure you'd need to support a lunar economy. Mining the moon for water is still an abstract idea. For one thing, science instruments have yet to determine how icy the lunar south pole actually is. Upcoming missions may find little of economic value, Logsdon said, or they could kick off a full-blown lunar rush. This decade will be pivotal for our future in space, but it's too early to say exactly where we'll be in 10 years' time. Space exploration is always at the mercy of shifting budgets and political priorities. Although he knows that historians can get such predictions wrong, Siddiqui doesn't think that the world will slip into another lunar lull. "We're in a very different stage of our interaction with space," he said. "In the years since Apollo, humankind has dispatched robots across the solar system, built gigantic space telescopes, and become comfortable living in the weightlessness of the International Space Station. Humans themselves have not traveled beyond the moon, but with the current lunar frenzy, our future as an off-world species feels more within reach than ever before." The last article was edited for time, as we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.